Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. My co-hosts this week, every week, Max Linsky, Aaron Lammer. Hey, guys.
Hey.
You sort of said like you wished like maybe this week would be different.
I didn't mean for it to come out that way. Another week, same hosts. Yeah. Probably some of the listeners feel that way.
These guys, still these guys.
Yeah. Someone asked us how long we've been doing this show, and I had to do that math that's divided by 52, and I somehow I just screwed it up, and it came out to 5 years. So I was like, oh god.
You could have done that math on our third year anniversary party, which was very recently.
We have those fudgy kind of anniversary parties, though. Who's on the show this week?
This week I talked to Jessica Hopper. I am holding in my hands her book, which is called The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. She started writing about music when she was 15, 16 years old. And she has spanned many genres. She's written about all types of music. She's the most music knowledgeable person possibly that I've ever talked to. But she also talks about writing and her career, how she got into it, and recently a lot of discussion around women in the music industry that has sort of stemmed from her Twitter account in a really interesting, also somewhat disturbing way. So it was a great interview.
I know you've been waiting to do this one for a long time, so I'm glad it happened. I have a question, though. Sometimes when you talk to these people about pop culture, you get a little nervous about your own sort of pop culture fluency.
It's a lack of fluency, possibly bad taste.
did your bad taste emerge in this interview is what I'm asking.
No, I wasn't can we just, let's talk about the Allman Brothers. When I was 16, I loved the Allman Brothers. That's not true anymore, by the way. I'm not a huge Allman Brothers fan or something, but.
It's okay. No shame.
I mean, they're all right.
I like the Allman Brothers.
Anyway, I know I didn't try to assert my own critic's voice about pop culture. I think I just mostly wanted to hear from her.
Aaron, if you were going to assert your voice, man, how'd you do it?
Assert my voice?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
That doesn't sound like me. I'm a passive-voiced individual. But sometimes I like to bring that passivity to the masses, and I would do it with MailChimp. They provide the best email service for businesses in the game. Over 8 million companies rely on them. My favorite feature is that you can get up to 2,000 subscribers for free with MailChimp. So you can actually start a mailing list without even putting your credit card down. And then as you grow, they grow with you. Thanks, MailChimp.
Here's Evan with Jessica Hopper.
Jessica Hopper, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. And good morning.
You're a Chicago person. You're a Chicago resident. You've worked in Chicago for a long time.
Not quite 2 decades, no.
Do you identify yourself as sort of being not of New York or not of LA when it comes to music criticism? Is there something specific about being from Chicago or working out of Chicago that you feel makes your work different?
I think being in Chicago allowed me to have the career that I have in a lot of ways and do the kind of writing that I do. In part because when I started freelancing full time, I was living in an apartment and where my rent was $250 a month.
What year was that?
About 10 years ago. It was a dump, but I was splitting it with somebody. But having really cheap rent, working in a city that had an alt weekly where I was expected to do 1,200 words a week of, thoughtful essay. And Worst case scenario, if I didn't get very much work that month, I could DJ a couple parties or something like that. That it wasn't, I had a lot of space in my life to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had a lot of freedom because my expenses were so low to say no to a lot of things that I didn't want to do so that I could just concentrate on the kind of writing that I wanted to be doing. And also, if I wanted to take 2 weeks where I basically did nothing but research or read about a certain thing or just go to the library a bunch or whatever it was that I wanted to do, it allowed me to do it there. I didn't have to knock myself out on the hustle, that I would have had to if I had been in New York, but also it took a... I think in other ways, my career grew really slowly, too, got to incubate. And, if I was in New York, I would have had to be knocking myself out and doing all the things that you have to do to survive as a freelancer in the world that I work in New York.
Yeah, it's a different set of pressures.
Yeah, too. I mean, it's a real small pond in Chicago, and I mean, I know like three other people that write about music for a living in Chicago.
Really?
You know, I mean, I think there used to be, I mean, that's in part because there used to be more jobs. I probably knew 12 people at one point, but I would say, it's probably under 10
oh, wow.
people at this point.
Well, it seemed also from just reading back a lot of pieces, both that are in the collection and then finding other pieces elsewhere, that there's something about it to me that you must know the music that has come out of Chicago as well as anyone alive, almost. Like, you've been in, there's references to being in clubs and like finding new acts, and then like hip hop artists that have come out of Chicago. And do you feel like staying in one place and like being of that place gave you some insights into sort of the way music has evolved over the last 20 years?
I mean, I hope so, but part of it was that one of my beats, which you don't see it really in the book because it's kind of a different kind of writing than is collected in the book, but one of my regular gigs for a long time was that I was the local music columnist for the Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And so every week I wrote about somebody who was probably first of three on a Monday night at the Empty Bottle. And so I had to keep tabs on things. Mm-hmm. That was a great thing to be able to do. I feel very close to the city in that way. And also, it's rare in the last couple of years that we've had any sort of like breakout act from Chicago. Hmm. You know, when I moved to Chicago, Chicago was really like the center of indie rock in America in a lot of ways. And that changed and evolved and it's been lying fallow in some ways for a while. But what drew me to it was that it was such a great town for music and that, you know, you could see like the most amazing free jazz shit on a Tuesday night and then go to see like a hardcore band at the Fireside Bowl and then go see, you know, whatever. It's like I have this really distinct memory of, I think I'd lived in Chicago for like 2 years at that point. In one night, like I went to go see like a punk band at the Fireside Bowl, went to go see Lauryn Hill and Outkast at the Chicago Theater, and then went to go see June of 44 at Lounge Jacks, like all in the same night. And it was just like all of them were some of the greatest shows I ever saw. And I was just like, Chicago, you know. I think Chicago has just historically been such a musically vibrant city, and that it really does inspire me in that way. And also, you know, being someone who is like a journalist tasked with like documenting the local scene, you want to try to understand it so that you can put people within, you know, put it all in perspective. And also, you know, when you're writing for a daily paper, you know, you have to know your shit.
Yeah. So let's talk for a second about how you ended up in Chicago, because I feel like there's a little bit of background in your book and throughout your pieces. And I've also been reading a bunch of interviews about sort of how you got into music writing. You didn't come to it through, you know, the J school or even college route.
No. I barely graduated high school.
So how did you first, I mean, you started writing about music very young. How did you get into that? How did you approach it?
I mean, basically it started because someone told me I couldn't do it.
Who told you couldn't do it?
There was a local music publication in Minneapolis that was a monthly, and they'd written something about Babes in Thailand where I was like, this person does not understand my favorite band. Fuck all y'all. And I called them and I was like, I want to write a corrective. And
like a response to a review kind of?
It was like a feature. And yeah. I was like, and I just, what I remember is that the way that people were writing about Babes in Thailand at the time was like, that they were caustic, that they were screamy, that they were amateur. And so much of what I knew about punk rock historically at that time was from reading about it.
And you were
15.
15.
I'd been into music for like at that point probably 10 months. I was like, I am an expert and I have a job at a record store. Okay. But that's how you are when you're 15. You're like, I am a genius. Well, maybe I was, but you know, I was confident that like my voice counted even if someone else didn't see it like that. I was like, this band means everything to me. Like, so I should be the one to be writing these things.
Where do you think that came from? Like the confidence that your voice counted. Can you pinpoint like parents or?
I mean, I sort of the sort of trifecta that I identify is that I identified as a feminist by the time I was like in fourth and fifth grade. Soon, I don't know if I necessarily used that word, but I think I was probably saying like, you know, women's rights or something, you know. Women's lib, said the fourth grader. My parents were journalists,
mm-hmm.
and I was a Montessori weirdo until eighth grade.
Hmm.
And Montessori is very much about being autodidactic and learning by doing and learning by failing. And it sees the value of risk very much in that way. That's how you learn.
Hmm.
And I think you can look at my career and say like, yes, she learned by fucking up a lot. Those were the things that were sort of, by the time I was a teenager, I was like, those three things together just sort of were like, yeah, I can do this.
Huh.
And it wasn't so much like, oh, yeah, my mom's editor of the paper. I can do this too. But that I had respected it a lot. But and just was like, this is like, it's hard to explain what it means to you when you like literally like grow up in a newsroom.
Uh-huh.
Journalism is like a way of participating in the world and one that was familiar to me. Though, say, writing about a band was very, very different than what my parents were doing at that time. Like, mm-hmm. when I was in high school, my dad was with the Associated Press from, I think, 75 until last year.
Oh, wow.
Based out of Mexico City and covered South and Central America throughout the 80s.
Oh, wow.
So my dad lived pretty far away from me, but, you know, and he was, like, a guy who was, like, camped out in a hotel room for weeks waiting for Manuel Noriega to leave. Like, that's what my dad did for a living. And was, like, traveling with the Contras and, you know, took me on a vacation to El Salvador once in the 80s.
Just like, you know, like, it's a great place to take your kid in the 80s.
He taught me how to drive when I was, like, 10. You know, my dad was really, like, I'm my dad's only kid, and I benefited from maybe his just sort of like, well, why wouldn't I teach my daughter to do these things or take her these places or like literally take her to the jungle with me?
Yeah.
You know, and I grew up in my mom's newsrooms. She was managing editor of the Minneapolis Star Tribune by the time I was in high school, but that she had been at, she'd been at weeklies and dailies. She also is the person that fires David Carr at the beginning of Night of the Gun.
That is amazing.
Yes. But then,
have you talked to her about it?
Yes, I mean, it, you know, he was a family friend, very much missed. And, but, you know, that was just like what I did. Like, I read the paper when I got home from school every day.
Yeah.
Like, starting when I was like a young child, like, because that's what my parents did. You know, I read, you know, all the magazines that my parents got in the mail when I got home. Like, I was like kind of a weird loner kid anyways. And it was like, I cared about things like, even whatever, like the dumb local music journalism, like I wanted it to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
God damn it.
So the music magazine, I take it they did not agree that you should be able to write a response.
They did not take me up off on my offer. But the woman that took the message is still my friend.
Oh, funny? Really?
Yeah. And she was like, I told them we should call you back. And, you know, but I think I said in the message, like, I'm 15. You know, I think it was between 9th and 10th grade. I still had braces. I mean, I looked like I was probably 12.
But that in some way drove you a little bit? Just the first rejection?
Long story long. Long form podcast, very long. You know, when you're 15 and your whole life is punk rock and somebody tells you can't do anything, you know, that you can't do this thing, what do? You do it. That was it. And so I just went and started making a fanzine, and then shortly after my fanzine came out, it was called Hit It or Quit It, and the first one I made was about 40 pages, and I distributed. I was very, you know, I printed up 300 copies. I mean, I really was like, I expect people to read this.
Ambitious print run.
Yeah, and it sold out. And by the time I started working on two, I was occasionally writing for City Pages, and I was writing for that same place that told me no, and became a columnist there. by the end of high school, and wrote for any place that would have me in Minneapolis and other fanzines. And then, you know, when I was 19, I started writing for Spin. That was like my first national.
At this point, did you say, I'm not going to college. I've gone pro. I'm already doing what I want to do.
I was already doing everything I wanted to be doing. Why would I stop and go to college to learn how to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, I hadn't visited any colleges, and I was so, like, autodidactic that my parents basically thought, like, oh, she'll figure it out if she's going to do this.
Hmm.
And so, like, we kind of just didn't take care of that. I fell asleep on my ACTs, and so it looked like I cheated because I got, like, a perfect score on half, and then the other half was, like, literally not even filled in. So I was like, fuck it. I'm moving to L.A. That's how I got to L.A.
It's a fascinating path. I mean, we have a lot of journalists on this podcast who just sort of like went to college and then like moved up in this sort of very standard way. And I think starting so early and then figuring it out on your own.
Well, you know, the other thing was that I was working with music, and I thought I had to move to L.A. to like do that. Also, at that point, by the end of high school, I'd literally had like every job in Minneapolis that was related to music that I could have other than like working at a venue. And
were you, did you play music? You played music as well.
Yes, poorly.
Oh.
And I played in bands, and that story should end there. and I moved to LA because I thought that's where I had to move to. Well, I mean, back then in 1994, that's, no, not 1994. When did I graduate from high school? 93. If you were going to work in the music industry, that's what you kind of had to go do, was move to L.A. And I did that, and then after a year, realized, like, I didn't actually need to do that. And so I was working with music and wanted to be a publicist, and because that's what I'd been working, doing kind of on the side in high school.
Were you doing that as you wanted to work in the music business, or that was a job that would enable you to write about music and be involved in the music scene and be able to write on the side?
Everything I did was an expression of fandom, basically. I wanted to cheerlead these bands that I loved. I liked helping in that way. It felt noble, you know? I was pretty idealistic about independent music in that way at that time and that age. But I didn't look at writing as a career until I'd been doing it for about 10 or 11 years.
So even after you were writing for Spin, I mean, Spin was a big deal at that time.
Yeah.
But so when you started writing for Spin and you were, what, 19, or you didn't think, I'm going to be a magazine writer.
I was so outside that game. I didn't even know how to approach it. I mean, it was like a distant city in the horizon, you know? I didn't. But also the kind of writing I was doing then and putting in my fanzine, as much as I loved making my fanzine, and I did my fanzine from the time I was 15 till I was 28, there's a reason that there's not a lot of stuff in the book from that time. My record reviews were basically making fun of bands at length and or showing off my, you know, being really like precious and showing off my music knowledge that someone who's 22 shouldn't have, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, typical shit. But I did love to write and I did love to make a magazine. But again, to get back to like the influence of having journalist parents, editor parents, is that I thought, not that I was illegitimate, but like in 1994 or whatever, my dad was like on assignment in Mogadishu. What I was doing was not journalism. It was like a hobby and it was fun. And also back then, pre-internet, everyone was just expected to participate to sort of keep the like economy of things alive within independent music. And that was kind of also what a fanzine was. I have a very distinct memory of going to a show in Minneapolis as a teenager and hearing someone who I very much respected in the scene talking about how, oh, that guy, he just goes to shows. Like, he doesn't play in a band, he doesn't book anything, he doesn't make a fancy, he doesn't write, doesn't any of that. He doesn't put bands up at his house. He doesn't do his part. And that's really how I read it. And I was like, I'm going to do a fanzine. I got to do a fanzine. I got to have something to show for being here at First Avenue every week.
And was there a point that you can remember when you soured on doing publicity, or at a certain point, you did transition into being just a writer.
Yes.
And what?
And it was funny. I could have done it earlier. That was like, that's like one of the great like sadnesses to me of my like adult writing career, is that I was so frightened to just jump off into full-time freelancing. And I thought, can I really write? Can I really keep up with that? Can I really do the kind of writing that this requires of me? And I jumped off into it, and I literally just had like, people were like, oh yeah, we've been waiting for you for like 2 years so that you don't have any conflicts of interest. And I was like, oh, you know, like here I am. I think I'm like jumping off a cliff, and I'm not like the ground like rose to meet my feet.
There's all these people.
And I was like, oh, so it was just me. And, it, you know, not going to college had made me feel like a little illegitimate, in part because, you know, all of my good friends in writing and what I was doing, you know, we're out here and we're really like had it going on, mm-hmm. you know, Sasha Fair Jones and John Carmonica and, you know, all my spin friends and Julianne Escobedo Shepherd and all of these people that were like my friends that I like clamored to like, I just wanted to be like as smart and cool and funny and, you know, whatever, all the things that they were when they wrote. And a lot of those people had gone to college. A lot of those people had gone to really good colleges. Sometimes I felt sort of like outside of that, you know, of course, because I was in Chicago and I was writing for a weekly and that didn't even have a website. And
the reader didn't have a website.
I mean, it that came at a point, but like it was like under like this really bizarre per article paywall. It was really strange and arcane. But the great thing was that, you know, for the first like couple of years I was writing for them, you made like royalties basically if people accessed the archives because they had to pay like 71 cents to read your piece.
Yeah.
I don't think people outside of Chicago were like really even reading me or able to. And so in some ways I felt sort of like, oh, I'm in this other world. I'm in this sort of like third tier world or something. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like New York, when you're 28 or whatever, seems like the heart of legitimacy or whatever.
Yeah.
But then once I started writing full time, I think I realized what I was doing was pretty legit.
Yeah. And did it flip into it all? Like, you know what? Fuck these people who went to college. Like, I have a unique perspective because I came up a different way.
You know, I sort of flitted in and out of that, but that my wonderful editor, Kiki Ablon, who was my editor at The Reader and was thankfully the hardest editor I ever had, in part because she expected so much from me, and I really had to rise to the occasion. And that's what she would tell me. It was like, well, we just, you know, basically we're teaching you how to write because we want you to do this and do this well. The thing was, is that I came back from the EMP pop conference, you know, which is like our, people write about music, like our deeply nerdy weekend long summer camp, basically. Mm. And I came back and, you know, felt dwarfed by the intellects that I was in the room with, and, you know, listening to Grail Marcus speak and being like, I can barely follow along with this. And I came back and I think I was telling Kiki like, yeah, I feel like I need to go to college or like audit some classes at Medill or something. And she's like, it will take all the reasons you're writing is special and it will ruin it. Don't go to college. Hmm. Don't go to J school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, I trust Kiki implicitly. So I didn't.
Hey, this is Aaron, your other host, with a quick word from our sponsor, Blue Apron. You may empathize with this. I'm at the end of my day here. It's about 6:15 p.m., and I don't know what I'm having for dinner. I don't want to go to the grocery store and make a big complicated meal, nor do I want expensive, unhealthy takeout. Is there a third option? There is! Blue Apron. They will deliver farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your home for less than $10 a meal. Now, each one of these is a unique recipe. You'll get to learn to cook with specialty ingredients that are normally hard to find. You can make stuff that's perfect for date night, cooking with friends. They have family plans if you've got kids. Each meal is about 500 to 700 calories, although it tastes significantly better, takes under half an hour to make, and comes with shipping that is both flexible and free. I'm just looking over this menu where you never get things twice. I would like some of these things at least once. Salmon with quinoa, lemon herb butter, and roasted broccoli. Yes. Let's see. Crispy Cajun catfish with Cajun rice and spicy remoulade. Don't know how to pronounce that, but still, yes. Anyway, I really recommend checking them out. If you would like to take the question of what am I having for dinner out of your day, you go to blueapron.com/longform. You'll get 2 free meals and you'll be supporting the show. Thanks, Blue Apron. They truly are a better way to cook. Our next sponsor is Fracture. They print your photos in vivid color directly on glass. Fracture has been described as HDTV for your photos. And I think the comparison's kind of apt, actually. You stroll into a room, you see someone with an old boxy TV, you go, what's going on there? I feel the same way about framed photos after I've seen the magic of Fracture. They ship everything you need to get your photos on the wall or desk right in the box, with prices starting at $15 for a 5x5 print. 5x5, that's a square. So if you've been really liking something you put on Instagram, why not give it as a gift to maybe an older person who does not have Instagram? Maybe you have a new hobby, a new animal. I personally like to document the lives of my cats extensively. I could take that a step further by getting them up on my wall in glass. So what I want you to do is go to fractureme.com, put in coupon code LONGFORM. You'll get 15% off and help support this show. Thanks, Fracture. Here's Evan back with Jessica Hopper.
So I want to ask you about what it takes to be a music critic, because I'm kind of fascinated with this, partly because when I started out in journalism, I did a little bit of music reviewing, and I just realized, like, I cannot do this. Like, this is not for me.
This is basically my one skill. This is the one thing I know how to do.
I know. So I feel like you are a person who can tell
me.
It strikes me that one of the things that's really difficult about music criticism is that you have to maintain a certain enthusiasm and love for music. Like when I was, you know, in my 20s, as like millions upon millions, if not everyone, like there was music that mattered to me so much. It was so important to me. And I listened to it and made me feel a certain way. It seems like you have to sort of maintain that love of the importance of music as your career goes on, but also this sort of like critical distance. But I could be wrong about that, because maybe you don't need the critical distance. Maybe it's more about investing yourself in the music. So I guess I'm curious how you approach your sort of love of music in combination with writing about it and it being work.
I'm still the same, you know, quote unquote fangirl I was at 15.
Mm-hmm.
I just turned 39. I think critical distance is overrated. But, you know, I mean, that's my stock and trade, I guess. I think you have to really give a shit. It really has to be your life in some ways. Music is how I understand the world. It's certainly got a lot more complicated since high school, you know, having that as like a framework. And the last super chunk record I think it's called I Hate Music. There's a lot of that record is about a good friend of Max, good friend of the band's dying, and you know, basically the sort of like myth of that young idea when you're really young and you're like, music saved my life, music can save my life, and then you're like 40 and people actually die, and there's things that, like, you know, your life evolves and you have children and you are older and music can't be your life in the same way, but still, it's your framework. And like, I think to write about music as an adult and love it in the same way is complicated. Family is complicating. Being a feminist always is complicating how I adore popular music. But to have that distance and that, I mean, that's like the thing you have to balance. But I do think distance from it is overrated. I don't have a lot of interest in reading about things that are, you know, that sort of hold them up clinically and examine them at an arm's length. And I'm not interested in criticism that's like, this song is good, this song feels bad. And I'm not trying to say the way that I do criticism is like the right way, because I'm like, this is how I view the world through this Cat Power record.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know what I mean?
That gets to one of the things that seems so difficult to me about it, is that even the value of music is so connected to who's listening to it. I was never a punk person. I'm like the least punk person. And so if I listen to punk music, I can appreciate it in a little more of a clinical way. Like, I understand why people like this. But if you're writing about music, it seems like you can't just say, this music is no good. These people don't know how to play their instruments. Like, that's the kind of like bullshit way of approaching it. Like, you have to somehow capture what it's about, mm-hmm. not just what the literal music is, which seems mm-hmm. to me to be a very difficult thing to do.
I mean, I don't think I got to that point. I don't think I was able to write about music in that way until I was like beyond just kind of that surfacey way until I was like 8 or 10 years into doing it.
Hmm.
It's hard to get 10 years deep into anything.
And then it seems like it's easy to fall. You referenced this, like the Riot Girl kind of movement and mm-hmm. and how easy it is for people to, as they get older, sort of say, well, this is what we were doing then, and
that
no one's
important.
Doing it now. Yeah, it was important then, but no one gives a shit now. And you can sort of age up into this belief that like everything was better back when you were
younger. That's sort of like, I mean, I feel like the last 14 years, like the 90s just don't die. They're like cast in amber as like this, you know, music's perfect time when we had magazines and we had this and we had Riot Girl and Kurt Cobain was alive. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
If you can't see that there's things that are happening that are incredible evolutions of some of those ideas that are more vital, that are more inclusive, that are more powerful, you are totally missing out. And you're also not acknowledging like the ways that a lot of those things were really deeply flawed. Sure, they were like the best we could do then, but we can do a lot better now. You know, even though there's a whole section devoted to nostalgia in there, I'm pretty anti-nostalgia.
Yeah, because nostalgia, I mean, it feels very of a piece with music writing. I think a lot because of Rolling Stone. I mean, Rolling Stone is a nostalgia vehicle in many ways. And I really like Rolling Stone.
And it's one of the only four magazines about music still being published.
Right, right.
It's like, I make a joke that the Pitchfork Review, where I am editor-in-chief.
You are the editor-in-chief of the Pitchfork Review.
Tut-tut-tut. I tend to think we're the only music magazine that's just about music. There's like four music magazines now. It's Rolling Stone, Rolling Stone Country, Us, and The Fader. And The Fader has like fashion-y stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We only have music.
Hmm.
Rolling Stone has politics. Rolling Stone Country is whatever Rolling Stone Country.
I'm not familiar with Rolling Stone Country.
Basically, I think it's like a devotional fanzine to Miranda Lambert, but I could be wrong. And while our magazine is like retrospective, I try to do it without nostalgia, without that sort of like, that was better. Like, I feel like we should be able to look at music's past and evaluate it with like our kind of a contemporary, you know, current context and all that, you know, time has imbued on it, whatever. But that we can do that without blotting out everything that's happened since.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like that's fair, and I think it ages us, and I think it distorts things.
Yeah. That approach implies that music is sort of better or worse in an objective way, that it was better and now it's worse, or vice versa.
And to not see that it's all fluid. You know, sometimes we go through periods of times where I just think there's like not great music for like a few months.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you're keeping up on stuff, you're like, we're kind of like a little lull right here, you know, or like last year was better, you know, or like something like that. But it's like, you have to realize like how fluid it is, but also it's like, I always think about how fucking furious I would get reading, you know, different critics, particularly, you know, people who are older, and of course, you know, so they had like a big platform or whatever.
Yeah.
Esteemed critics who would be like, you know, whatever it is, you read like Robert Hilburn in the LA Times or something. I remember reading something like, John Fogerty still got it, and like blah blah blah, and the kids today, you know. And it's just like, oh god, like someone fucking put me out in the pasture if that ever becomes me. And so anytime I start to even get like sort of like whiff of that, like, you know, in my own mind or brain or heart or whatever, that's like when I'm like, okay, I need to just like go open up Bandcamp in my browser and just put in like Chicago, or put in like new Riot Girl feminist or like whatever, and just see what like terms come up and like what's the shit someone put out this week.
Hmm.
And that's what I do, and I'm always like, oh my god, this person is a genius.
Hmm.
Oh my god, I love this, you know. It's like and basically like reinvigorate or stimulate or wake up that part of me that is still completely like thrilled by discovery and loves finding out about something new that speaks to me, you know?
Mm-hmm. I really love this piece. It's from The Reader that's about this guy, David Bazan, who's like a Christian rocker, was a sort of like Christian rocker. What was the name of that band that he was
Pedro
in?
Pedro the Lion.
Pedro the Lion.
Everyone check out Pedro the Lion Records. It's just fantastic.
Because they kind of like, they had a little bit of mainstream success, if you could call it that.
I was their publicist, and yes, I would call it that.
Yes, that's a place where I wanted to start, which is you were the publicist. I think what makes this piece so interesting to me is that we talked at the beginning about how, you know, quote unquote, music can save your life and what that means and what music means to you. And this is an example of this guy is a Christian in the Christian rock world, and then he starts to have doubts, and then he starts writing essentially not just secular music, but almost like anti-Christian in some ways.
Well, you know, he made basically his whole catalog largely about his relationship with faith, and then he starts to, you know, he made a couple of really incredible records where kind of at the height of, you know, Bush years, culture war, et cetera, that sort of reflecting on, you know, the religious right and incredible parables. I mean, he's an incredibly gifted songwriter, and just sort of saying, like, that's not, if that's like your version of Christianity, I don't want it.
Yeah.
And that starts to give away to something else entirely as it sort of ebbs away from him. He's someone who grew up in a Christian college and married at 22, and his parents are, you know, in the ministry and all of this stuff. And his music, in a way, is, you know, just so much built around an expression of faith. And then he basically starts drinking to blot out the thought, God does not exist. And he finds his way to, you know, a measure of sobriety and agnosticism, and then is invited back to play the Christian festival that he once headlined for the first time as an agnostic.
And then it's not just that he plays, it's like he has to have like a Q&A.
He does.
Because the fans are so, they're grappling with these questions.
But he, after this point, he starts basically doing, he pioneered this sort of idea of like living room tours in some ways. He sells them as ticketed events, in part so that he's in people's houses and they sit at his feet and ask him questions. And he like shows up for them in that way, in part because it's sort of like, and you know, say this in the piece, it's like he flips that script of like, you might be the only Christian someone ever meets. He is probably the only agnostic that Christian kids are going to get to own a record by.
Yeah.
Because he's like this name brand Christian dude.
You worked with all these bands, then you become a full-time writer. What is the relationship with having been a publicist and now going in to write about these same musicians?
It took me 2 years before somebody would take that story, that Dave Bazan story, because I had been his publicist.
Really?
I pitched it every which way I possibly could. Spin, GQ, Rolling Stone, everybody's like, this is an incredible story. Please let me report this. And the only way it was ever actually to, you know, was able to be taken by The Reader is that this Christian festival happens in downstate Illinois, close enough that we consider it local. And they're like, let's just try it. You know, but they're like, you have to be really clear about your relationship with him. But I hadn't spoken to him in years.
It's in the first paragraph of the story.
Get it right out of the way so that people could. And it wound up being, it's the biggest music story The Reader ever had.
I mean, in any of those magazines you pitched it to, it would have been so.
That's what I thought. But you know what? The story of that story, and also like probably the four or five biggest pieces I've ever done, I always tried to like broadcast this, is that those were the stories nobody would take. I mean, I had to fight for those stories. Nobody wanted the BuzzFeed advertising story. Nobody wanted R. Kelly. No one wanted this Dave Bazan piece. There's another piece or two in there that I'm forgetting.
Yeah.
Five biggest stories of my career that have basically defined my career are the stories that, like, I was pitching them for, like, you know, 18 months, or they were things that everybody turned down.
And do you think for different reasons for each?
Because they're, in part because they're difficult, they were difficult stories.
Yeah. The R. Kelly one is people didn't want to talk about it, or they just were ignoring it. Yeah.
People didn't care. I also thought people didn't care. I thought maybe 10,000 people would read it, and I wanted it to exist in part for editors and other people to start a discussion.
And then the BuzzFeed piece is really a kind of like lightning rod subject in some ways.
Well,
about people selling their music
to
advertising.
Said, "Well, how do we tell this story? This is a bunch of meetings. How do we show what's happening? A lot of this is just meetings.
Yeah.
I needed to do that story because I basically had a new baby. And I was like, what can I do that is a national story that I can report just locally? Huh. And that I can take my time with, because I basically work during nap time and I can barely afford a babysitter and, you know, all this stuff.
Right.
And I was like, what do we have here? We have advertising. Okay, I know some people really die up in music world advertising. I'll just do this.
Was that Steve Kendall?
And Steve, at that time, Steve had been my editor at Spin and had taken some stories that nobody wanted to let me do. You know, like the Lana Del Rey piece. He's a fantastic editor. I've learned so much from him. And he's like, I'm going someplace where I could probably take this story. And I reported it for 11 months, like just incrementally.
That story is about, I mean, in a way, it's about this idea of like selling out. That's mm-hmm. always like pervasive in mm-hmm. question, you know, artistic endeavors. And it's interesting that you went the other way in some ways to what people would, like you're a publicist. Like a lot of journalists mm-hmm. end up in other mm-hmm. publicity or marketing or something because it's hard to make a living as a journalist mm-hmm. in many ways. And you kind of like started in what would be like considered the sellout position. I'm not saying it is.
I was part of the machine.
Yeah.
You know, I manufactured the narrative. You know, I used my journalist brain to kind of sell bands.
Yeah.
You know, back when I did that. Like what part of this is the good story? I mean, the thing about working in the music industry for as long as I did before I went into full-time writing, the analogy I always use is like, you know, you work in the kitchen of a restaurant long enough and you never want to eat there again because you know what goes in the food.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really it. And I think in that way, that helped informed, both the how selling out saved indie rock, that BuzzFeed piece, and Passion of Dave Bazan. Just understanding what it really takes for people to cross over the machinations of it all, the function of the industry and how things are sort of trickle down, you know.
Yeah, it seems like you're partly now working as an editor. You worked as a music editor at Rookie, mm-hmm. and now at Pitchfork and editing the Pitchfork Review, where you are editor in chief. Partly what I want to ask is, what has that transition been like to have been this music writer for all these years and now to be an editor for oftentimes probably much younger music writers who are kind of coming up?
Much, much younger music writers. Dear listener, I'm actually a very spry 70. I mean, that's part of the reason I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Especially after putting together the book and reread probably 90% of what I've ever written, which is, if anyone is looking for a truly humbling and painful experience, I would really recommend read everything you've ever written.
All just go for it. Just go. 15 or 16.
Just dig in. And I don't know why I started at the beginning. Like, I literally, like, in earnest was like, I'll just go crack up in this like moldy box in my garage and I'll just start with ninth grade. And I, like an hour later, I was like, this book's going to be 4 pages long. Anyways, I put together the book. And when I got to the book, the end of the book, and the incredibly, you know, year-long editing process of it, you know, just really culling it and then having that and then having that and having that until we got down to, I think, the 43 pieces. But, you know, we literally started with hundreds.
Yeah.
And when I got to the end of that, I was like, oh, I've taken a lot of my big ideas to their natural conclusion. I've explored them fully. I can see that. I want to kind of lie fallow in a way for a little while until what will be my next big idea? What will be my next framework? What will be the thing that takes me the next 10 years? And that was sort of where I was right at the time that, you know, I had started working on the Pitchfork Review as a senior editor, but it was very part-time. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got a call from Mark Richardson, who's the editor-in-chief at Pitchfork and my boss, you know, wonderful editor, and was like, do you want to come run the pitch? And I was like, sure. I've never had a job.
But you seem to have taken to it. When I see people, you know, periodically there's things on Twitter where people are like, to say who your favorite editor is, and Pitchfork writers say you, or several of them say have said you. I've seen it very recently. Not all writers are good editors, I know from experience. What was your approach in turning to that?
What I wanted to do by being an editor at Rookie and then later Pitchfork was to give young writers the same sort of editorial relationship I had at Chicago Reader, the same sort of expectations and opportunities, and the same sort of nurturing that I had at Spin.
Mm-hmm.
The Reader and Spin were really, you know, the defining editorial relationships. Those are the places I learned how to write.
But the conventional wisdom now is that nobody has time. Editors don't have time, especially when you're talking about digital.
That's why I edit the way I edit with people.
Mm-hmm.
Kiki used to give me top edits that would make me cry. And the sort of joke amongst some of the other younger writers are they're like, well, you're not truly a Reader writer until you get a top edit where you've cried when you receive it. I trusted them. They did so many things to make me trust them and say, no one's going to make you look stupid. And, you know, they made my jokes funnier. They made, you know, they just would ask me why, you know, and just make me keep digging down till I hit the real truth of a piece critically, or just, you know, making sure I just get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with so many incredible young writers, and I want to give them, however I can, the same opportunities to do great work that I did, and to bring who and how they are and their experience of the world into their pieces, because I think that is really, like, why there's so much great criticism happening right now, is kids who grew up on Tumblr and are really not particularly Catholic about their tastes and have absorbed the world, and they are bringing in their experience and understanding of the world as a person of color, as a trans person, as, you know, being young and queer and from the South and all of these things. And it's like we're in an era of, like, you know, a lot of the gatekeeping is gone, that we can, like, get everybody in, and, like, the canons can shift,
mm-hmm,
about music because of everybody who's writing about it, and we can have all of these new and exciting ideas being explored by all that people bring to it, and particularly young writers.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really try to coax a particular kind of fearlessness out of people that Twitter has bred into many people, because people, young writers in particular, I mean, everybody is, I think, to a certain extent, afraid of backlash from Twitter if you write something that's negative or that's very critical, or even if, you know, in the case of some young female writers that I work with, getting doxxed over critical pieces.
Yeah. We have not yet talked about the title of this book, which I know you are asked to talk about a lot. The title of the book, which we haven't even said yet, is The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. And it's sort of dealt with, like, immediately in introduction. Like, yes, there have been other books that, like, sort of touch on this, but actually, like, this is why I titled it this way. But who came up with this title? Did you come up with the title?
Yes.
And did you know from the beginning that that's what you wanted to title this book?
No, it was a joke.
Was it?
I was joking with Tim Kinsella. I remember it really distinctly. We had decided to do the book, and we'd had, like, a meeting in my living room or something, and we were walking out. He's like, well, what are we going to call this thing? And I was like, well, you know, it's The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic or something, you know, but I was, like, laughing when I said it. And he's like, is that it? That has to be it. No, that's it.
Really?
And we were kind of up against, like, a deadline of having to have a title for it.
But it's an incredible title. I mean, because it
I have an agenda.
Yeah.
You can't read my writing and not know that I have a staunch fucking agenda at all times. And my primary concern with the title, of course, was erasing anybody else's work, or having people think, like, I am the only one that did it, or,
right,
like, I paved the way.
Right.
Because none of those things are true. You know, sometimes I'm fearful in, like, the amount of attention that my book has gotten, which is substantial. Very fortunately, I have great publicists, whatever. And, you know, sometimes I talk to people and they're like, you paved the way. I was like, no. I read Rock, She Wrote when I was 16 years old, and I grew up in a city, you know, Minneapolis City Pages, when I grew up, Terry Sutton was the pop critic, and she was one of the, she was like the critic. I knew then when I was very first making a fanzine, I was part of a lineage because I had a book that showed me that.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, dozens of women had been doing this before me. I knew I was part of a tradition. I just would have assumed by now that all of those women would have had books too.
Right. That seems like the thing that it ties back into what I sort of like glancingly mentioned, which is on Twitter, you not that long ago sort of tweeted out people of color and women who have had bad experiences in the music industry.
What was your first experience of being told you didn't count?
Yeah, that was it. I mean, extraordinary responses, extraordinarily upsetting and depressing in many ways.
When did I start? That was like on a Wednesday. And by Saturday, it was like in the low thousands. It was 400 in the first day. In the first 19 hours, we storified it at 19 hours, and mm-hmm. it was 400.
And these are people saying, I had this experience at a show, or I had this experience from an editor, or what have you, that...
It was everything from being, like, groped at a show, or showing up at a show that you're going to play, and being told, like, sorry, no groupies, or whatever. Like, somebody literally carrying a drum kit to show that they're headlining, to people's experience of being sexually assaulted. So, I mean, it was like the gamut from, you know, casual sexism and microaggressions, but constant ones, perhaps, or significant ones. I mean, it's all significant to, like, people just kind of destroying other people's lives.
I mean, it so ties in with some of the pieces in the book. Like, you have this piece about emo music and how it did not find a place for women in that sort of scene. There's just a lot of pieces that sort of like, it feels like it was almost all leading to that point in a way for you to ask that question and then say, look, here it all is.
And you know, and here's the, I don't know if it's the irony, but, I was literally crowdsourcing something.
For to write something.
I had a speech coming up. I was keynoting Big Sound, which is like, the South by Southwest of Australia.
Uh-huh.
I was like the lady who was being asked to talk. And the thing I wanted to talk about was, like, I had a lot of early formative experiences where my curiosity and interest in music was met with encouragement. And so that when I was met with discouragement or people being scumbags, I was like, that's not the truth of this. The discouragement didn't keep me down because I had another experience to sort of buoy it. And I wanted to talk about, we have to, like, encourage young women and fangirls and, like, not marginalize fangirls. And that's what I was going to talk about.
Uh-huh.
And my friend and colleague, Molly Bushaman, one of our great critics at Pitchfork, was like, why don't you just ask around and see what are, like, some of the really common ways that women are marginalized? I was literally doing the lazy journalist thing and crowdsourcing. And this is what came of it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that I have to remind people when we're talking about this. Think about who you didn't see in that discussion, particularly women of color and people of color within the scene, like the different price that is to be paid for talking about the ways you're marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly, well, it was a lot of white women.
Mm-hmm.
And also the things that weren't being tweeted. The DMs and the emails that I've gotten since, basically we should create like a name and shame list or a shit list, post it in every fucking venue bathroom and burn this motherfucker down.
Mm-hmm.
That is my feeling mm-hmm. right now.
Do you feel like this all points you in a direction of doing something more than you're doing? I mean, in some ways, the thing that would come out of all of this would be, you should publish a book like the book that you just published.
You know, I'm not at liberty to talk about it right now, but, you know, some of us girls have some plans right now.
Oh, all right.
I know that probably sounds a little bit more ominous than it does, but, you know, you can't not do anything once you know all this stuff. You know?
But there's also just so much that it could make you feel like, what can you do? This is so, it was so pervasive.
It's really hard for me to talk about this without crying because there's so many more stories that I know in the last couple of weeks than what's just on Twitter.
Yeah.
And some women have very bravely shared so many things. I feel like, for the better, we can't see all of this and look away anymore. maybe if that's like the great thing to come of it. And then the other thing is women writing to me and saying, I was so isolated in this experience. Because since my keynote from Big Sound went on YouTube and I tweeted and some other people tweeted it, and it's seemingly becoming a very big deal in Australia particularly, which has an even more male-dominated set of industries than we do. I was realizing, like, I need to, if I have a room full of people who work in an industry and even some of them have power and the rest are going to be women that need to feel a sense of solidarity, okay, I'm just going to real talk this. Like, and that's kind of what happened. And then about 2 days before, a friend of mine who lives around Brisbane, a rookie contributor, was saying, you know, there's been a rash of drugging and sexual assaults at shows here. And I was like, okay, then we're going to just, I'm just going to go there. And I mean, you can sort of see in the, when I'm talking, it's like, I'm following my speech for about two pages. And then I just start basically talking from my heart, yeah, and my experience and my understanding of this. And the letters I've gotten since, you know, one of the women who's one of the nine professional sound women in Australia who's left the business because she can't get hired anymore, even though she's great at what she does. And women really pouring their hearts out, and they're telling me of their experience, and it's worse than we think. It's all worse than we think.
Yeah.
Because so much of it we don't see and we don't hear about, because so many women are just muted by experience, by literally just being crushed by what they have to go through to be here, to write, to make music, to go to shows. I don't know how to fix it. But the good thing is that people are asking me to come, and basically like, will you come to South by Southwest and give us this talk and
yeah,
have this conversation, and how can we do this? And I'm not by any means the only woman qualified to talk about this. I'm just the woman that's being given a platform right now. And so I sort of feel, I guess, like entrusted with some of this. And so that's why, like, any opportunity to speak, I'm talking about this stuff,
yeah,
more so than my book.
Yeah.
You know, my book's fine. It's going to do great. I'm on the fourth printing. It's been out 3 months. Like, it's going to be fine. I don't need to talk about my book or my work.
But I actually think the book is like really connected to this in a way, because the book is sort of like, in a different way, saying to all those people potentially, I have built a career unashamedly writing from a feminist perspective, and you can do it too.
And my book before this was that too, but
yeah,
it was for teenage girls, and it was about, you can go into Guitar Center and not be crushed by the experience. Here's what you need to know.
But that's what's so fucked about a lot of this stuff, is that the person you really need to talk to, or that really need to listen to you, are men.
And you know what? Because I am, in a lot of ways, in a lot of places that I've been, I am like the token girl that's let in the clubhouse. And I've always tried to force this conversation, whether people want to have it or not, because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Music is the great unifier.
Yeah. It just seems insane to not have the same diversity of people writing
and,
about music.
And yet, for decades, we had a canon that was dictated by old white men, that was made of old white men, that valued, you know, guitars and, like, men's romantic pain above everything else. And so much of criticism was about that. I mean, that's what the introduction, you know, or the piece that basically serves as like the introduction in my book is about, is like, you know, I was about 10 years into writing, and all of a sudden, you know, I read like the big Nick Tosh's collection and the 10th anniversary of Lester Bangs' Carburetor Dung. And, you know, there was like a handful of books that kind of all came out around then. And it was, you know, all the like canonical men and the Cream writers, and, you know, dudes that were like asking Patti Smith about her tits while they're interviewing her, you know, because it's like 1979 and you do that and like whatever. And I was like, I love this, and I love music in the same way that these wasted old men do, you know, whatever. Like, where do I fit in this? How I love music, how I participate, my experience of like going to shows and like not feeling safe. How does all of this fucking fit in here?
Mm-hmm.
I love Van Morrison the same way that Lester Bangs loves Van Morrison. Where do I fit in this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my life is saved by songs. I am the same creature as these craggly old dudes, but I am also not them at all. But this seems like this is their space,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I'm going to try to interlope into.
You mentioned, you know, sort of going fallow for a little while when it turns to writing about big ideas. Do you feel like you would hope that you would have another collection later in your career? Like, do you think you'll return to like this volume of writing and like feel like there's a sort of second chapter?
Well, part of the reason that I even had enough stuff to put in a book, I mean, you know, whatever I can say, like I'm 19 years into my career. Or 20, I guess. Yeah, so I started writing at 16. So yeah. What's that, 23?
23, yeah.
Fucking A, I've been saying 19 this entire press cycle. I'm an idiot. But part of the reason I even had enough stuff to work with is because I was freelance this whole time.
Yeah.
And I made shit word rate.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of it. And so I had to write 7,000 words a month at the Reader. You know, my national work basically came from Spin and later on GQ. And so I just had a ton to work with. And I don't know if I'll ever be freelance again and be able to, I mean, I don't know, but I filed to the Reader a weekly byline of probably 5 show previews, 2 album things. You know, I just was given a lot of space.
The hustle, the real hustle.
Yeah. And yeah. That's what this is kind of the product of.
Yeah.
And so if there's going to be another one, it might take a while.
Yeah.
I am working on a proposal for another book.
A different book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it has to do with women and music history. I like history because it's settled. There's the chapter or section in here that's called Real Fake.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually going to be book number 3. But the thing that changed my mind was when Taylor Swift's Shake It Off came out, because Taylor Swift was kind of part of the equation of that book
about uh-huh.
women and performance and authenticity in pop primarily. And it was like, that was such a seismic, like the reaction to that was such a seismic shift around the Taylor Swift discussion that I was like, what if I was 80% done with this book? And then the entire conversation about Taylor Swift changed. And then this book still isn't coming out for 18 months.
Yeah.
Like, no. And I was like, I'm going to just move on to my next idea, which is it takes place in the 70s. So it's set.
It can't be
seriously recontextualized. So it is firm. Well, it's staying in place.
I think we can agree if like some years from now you publish another collection and it's called the Section Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic, that would be disappointing all around. Like,
that better not fucking happen. You know, part of the whole thing in the introduction is because people told me that were like, there's no precedent for this. You know, and it's just like, what they were saying was there's no gendered precedent.
Right.
You know, because it's like the 129th billionth collection of criticism, but it's, you know, they're all dudes. And, or most of them. That I work with so many really great, brilliant young writers who should have a book in the next 3 years.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to hear what I heard for a decade about why this book can't exist.
How would you categorize what you heard?
People telling me feminist criticism doesn't sell. You're not well known enough. Anthologies don't sell. Essays don't sell. Music books don't sell. And while I'm being told this, it's like Rob Sheffield is like on New York Times bestseller. And I see like, you know, how many like jajillion printings of Chuck Klosterman books, you know, and I was just like, no, like this is like, I'm going to make that, but I'm going to make it for girls. Like, come on, they're there. They're waiting. Trust me, they are waiting. And people be like, eh. And it took my friend Tim Kinsella, who has worked in the same world that I am for 20 years. He inherited Featherproof from the people that started it. And he came to me and said, I want this to be the first book. And I was like, okay, good, because I pretty much have it ready.
Wow. It's a fantastic book. And it's,
thank you. I tried.
I hope that it keeps getting the attention that it deserves. Thank you for being on the podcast in this very hot podcast room that we have.
Thank you so much for having me. It is such a... I have to tell you, I was really particularly psyched to come be on a podcast that I love and learn from.
That's it for this week's long-form podcast. Thank you to Jessica Hopper for making time while she was very briefly in New York to come by. You should pick up her book, The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic. It's available everywhere. And thank you to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform. Thank you to our sponsors, who are Fracture, Blue Apron, and, of course, MailChimp. Our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, is fantastic. Our intern this week, very helpful, Molly Bain. And we'll see you next week. To do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.